takes about $2 billion to bring a drug to market, maybe a little more than that now. These are kind of crazy numbers to think about. The incentive for big pharma, at least, to support fundamental discovery, fundamental sort of drug development, and all of the challenges that are in their way, how do you think about preserving the value of the randomized clinical trial and making it maybe, or reshaping it? Do you think it needs to be reshaped for the next era of drug development?
Randomized controlled studies will always remain the gold standard. However, I think it's really important to be open-minded, to be able to introduce other ways of collecting the data, looking at the data. We have to be innovative. We have to be able to not expect something to be 10 years down the line, but maybe shorter, in order to be able to get an answer.
You're listening to Beyond the Chart with Stanford cardiologist Dr. Raj Dash, powered by Clint, the clinical intelligence platform. Today, Raj is joined by Rosa Coppoleccia, senior director at Bayer Pharmaceuticals.
Welcome, and thank you for joining the Beyond the Charts podcast, sponsored by Clint. I am Rajesh Dash. I am a co-founder of Clint and a cardiologist at Stanford University. And today on the podcast, we are very fortunate, and I am thrilled to introduce Dr. Rosa Coppoleccia. She's the senior director of global and the global clinical lead for thrombosis and vascular diseases at Bayer. And she's also an assistant clinical professor of medicine at Hackensack Meridian School of Medicine. She brings over 18 years of experience in the pharmaceutical industry with a particular focus on cardiovascular and preventive medicine. She's made really tremendous contributions, particularly in antiplatelet therapies such as aspirin, for both primary and secondary cardiovascular prevention. And she's instrumental in the design and execution of numerous phase 2 and 3B clinical trials, and has a deep understanding of regulatory frameworks by agencies such as the FDA and the EMA. Her career is marked by her dedication to advancing cardiovascular health and her interest in addressing health disparities, especially among women. Her work has been widely recognized, several honors, including the Heart Saver and Stroke Hero Award. And really, she's an expert, certainly on aspirin usage in cardiovascular disease, but has developed thought leadership amongst the health disparity problems that are sort of plaguing the industry right now, and has co-authored several peer-reviewed journal articles, and continues to lead innovation in research, particularly in decentralized clinical trials. So welcome, Rosa. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Raj. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, it's great to see you again. And I think for the audience and our listeners, it would be wonderful for us to just hear a little bit about how you got started in the industry. Your clinical background, yes, but what was the draw to join industry, and what were you passionate about, and what are you still passionate about in the pharmaceutical space now?
So when I started, I actually practiced in occupational medicine. That was where I began my career. I am an internist by training, and then I also went into occupational medicine, and I actually worked at Employee Health Services for Schering Plough for about 8 years. And while I was there, I did mainly primary care with the physicians, with the other physicians there, and with the patients, obviously treating the employees. We had over 6,000 employees at the time. But then after a while, it was sort of, I wasn't as fulfilled. And I had a lot of the individuals that I was working with that were in clinical development or in medical affairs or in regulatory that I used to speak to, and not just as colleagues, but they were my patients. And they sort of tried to introduce me to the other side of medicine, or a different side of medicine. And that's when I started becoming interested in the medical affairs, regulatory, clinical development. And I started to sort of decide that that's mainly where I would like to take my career. I believe that what really changed my trajectory was, you know, when I lost both my parents within a year, I also wanted to change careers. There was something about what was going on personally that I decided, well, I think I want to go into the research side. And so in 2005 is when I actually joined the pharmaceutical side of the business and was given the opportunity to work at Bayer as the associate medical director for Bayer Aspirin because they were growing the business, just building up the group. And it was such an, you know, everyone associates with Bayer Aspirin, right? It's trusted. It's a great drug. And I felt it was such an opportunity to be able to learn from that and to be able to build my career from that. And I would have never thought that I'd still be there 18 years later and working, having worked on aspirin actually for almost like 16 years and now in the world of thrombosis. So it's been an amazing opportunity and it's been a great experience and a lot of learnings.
Yeah. And then, you know, when I think in my career in cardiology, back and say, what are the things that have actually made substantial differences in outcomes? And there's very few things that have made the impact that aspirin has had, right? And you think about statins, certainly. I mean, they kind of put those two right up with each other, right? But the impact has been dramatic. And to be sort of at the center of that in terms of developing not just the evidence, but also the thought leadership to sort of say, you know, this is really something that needs to be done for all of these patients. And you know, it's gone through phases, right? There was the primary prevention for everyone over the age of 50 or whatever it was. And now that's not there anymore, but obviously still a vital medication for so many of these cardiovascular patients. Do you think we'll see the impact of another medicine or a class of medicines, the way that we've seen it with aspirin and maybe statins? Or do you think we're really now fine-tuning and sort of getting smaller incremental improvements from the newest agents that are out there?
You know, that's an interesting question. And I think something that we're all trying to find. It's so interesting how cardiovascular disease has changed over the last 20 years. As you said, with the introduction of the statins, with the introduction of the PCSK9 inhibitors, it's just very interesting. I don't know what else we can really look into to help change the progression of the disease or the progression of development of the disease. But I think that we have to really kind of always look to the patient as well and not just look at the medication and help educate them and help them understand the importance of the compliance of taking these drugs that are able to change the way that they you know, can change their risks, their modifiable risk factors. It's a lifestyle change. It's a medication change. But I think it's, you know, we may have saturated the field of cardiovascular disease. I'm sure there's, how can I say, places that we should be able to contribute. But I think it's, we've hit so many amazing milestones in the last 20 years with all the different ways that we do interventional science, with all the different medications. And now when you're dealing with AI and all this other stuff, I'm thinking more of like the wearable devices that people have that need to, that are also contributing to their health. And so it's just really important that we actually not just look at the medications, but also the other things that can help contribute to lessening cardiovascular disease.
Well, I love how you brought that back to the patient and their adherence, their understanding of why they need to take it. The ways that we educate patients have also changed, right? They educate themselves. And, you know, I think that's a risk. It's a challenge, I think, for me as a clinician, you as someone bringing really vital, proven therapies to market. And I think that, you know, being able to connect with patients in a different way is really where things are moving. And you brought up sort of some of the technologies that we have, wearables that you mentioned, but, you know, even telemedicine, right, which is, you know, cutting across geographic sort of and sort of distance related barriers to seeing a patient regularly, it has helped. You know, certainly during the pandemic, it was the only way to communicate. But, you know, for both clinical trials and for clinical care, it's proven to be effective. How do you view it? And how do you see things changing? Do you feel like it's helping reach new populations? Or do you feel like it's creating even more of a barrier between the haves and the have-nots in healthcare?
I think we made a big leap when COVID happened, and we actually were able to transition from in-office visits to telemedicine, and accept, for instance, decentralized trials versus traditional trials, where people can actually do things at home and get monitored at home without having to go into like the sites and continue with our research. I think the challenge, however, is that a lot of the patients, populations may not have the technologies or the level of education or ability to be able to benefit from these technologies that we have, that we can share with them. So I think sometimes we have the, we think that it's so easy for somebody to get internet. And we know that there are barriers for some individuals who don't pay for, can't pay for internet or don't have internet. They may have a phone, but they may not be able to access that internet the way that we think. Plus, I think a lot of the elderly patients, we have to remember that technology can be a challenge for them. As easy as it is, it's not always as easy for an older patient to maneuver the internet and understand a lot of the things that are out there when it comes to new technology and so forth.
Yeah, I mean, I think, well, your company, Bayer, has been really a thought leader in, not just a thought leader, but an implementation leader in bringing some of these technologies into the trial space, right? I mean, my first sort of direct interaction with you and the Bayer team was working on that decentralized trial, the DTaP trial, where we were really trying to solve barriers that AFib patients may have in terms of getting access to care, getting access to education, and adhering to their medications, right? And it worked. You know, we didn't have the most diverse patient population, as you may recall, but it was an opportunity that we took a step back and said we could have had a very diverse population and potentially also had great results. And it became, well, what I was so impressed by was how Bayer as a company sort of embraced that and took it forward into the design of a phase 3 trial. How do you see that process internally in your company? Because it strikes me as very progressive. Haven't seen other life science companies sort of take that route and trust that route.
Well, I think Bayer is very progressive. The fact that we actually did such a large study and added the decentralized portion to our cardiovascular study. And not only was it decentralized, but it was fully remote as opposed to a lot of the other trials that were hybrid. And so I think that that was, it was challenging, but also I think very fulfilling because it also allowed us to see that these things can be done. You know, nobody says it was an easy road. However, there was a lot of lessons learned and things that can be improved and things that we can do better for the next time. I think that we stand behind decentralized studies. I think it's a way that we can actually get to patients a lot easier than the traditional sites. And we're going to continue to hopefully look into those types of trials when it comes to moving forward. Depending on the disease state, you know, we'll have to see how that moves forward. I could say that in the cardiovascular space, that was definitely an exciting and a new way to do a study. And it really helped patients who couldn't make it to the sites. There was a lot of people who really were excited about not being able to go into a traditional site and do everything from home. But then, you know, we also have to realize that there are barriers with that as well, as I mentioned before, because people are not always able to have the internet or have the capabilities, you know, but it does make it easier for the caregivers as well. You don't have to have somebody drive you into a site. You don't have to drive yourself to a site. So there's a lot of positive things, I think, that come out of a decentralized trial. And I think it's really something that we will continue to do in the future and continue to progress in that direction.
So, I mean, you've focused a lot in your career on women's cardiovascular health, you know, women's health being a major focus of yours, and now seeing some of these technologies emerge and continue to be adopted more and more. Do you feel like that's a good thing in terms of your hopes and sort of efforts in improving women's cardiovascular health?
I think so. I'm very hopeful about what's happening with women and looking at their health. I think there's so much improvement that is still needed. I think women are still under the impression that that's not what is one of their main causes of death. They need to understand that cardiovascular disease is the number one killer, not just in men, but it also affects them. They may have different symptoms. They may, you know, so they need to be educated around that. They need to sort of understand that. Women as caregivers never put themselves first. And so I think they, you know, may not feel well and then end up, you know, showing up at a hospital or a doctor's office in a much more advanced disease state than others. So I think we need to educate our patients much more so. I don't think we are where we should be. I think it's really important to encourage women also to get into clinical trials, especially in cardiovascular disease. There's a very small percentage of women that are represented in those trials. And so it's really important to be able to get data, you know, and be able to interpret that data, both not just from a medication perspective, but also to understand the physiology of how we are different than men.
Yep.
If that makes sense.
It does. Yeah. And I think it's somewhat alarming when you think about the fact that trials have been so biased in terms of the representation of who's in them. And yet these are being approved by the FDA and other regulatory bodies for the masses, even though we don't actually know if they work for the masses. Which, you know, that, and that's where, you know, it brings me to another question, which is, first of all, there are many disparities in healthcare. There are many disparities in trials. Do you feel like real-world evidence is going to be useful in shining a light on disparities in outcomes and in treatment, and that would help inform a clinical trial that has a result that might not be in the most diverse cohort, but you bring in a real world data set to say, well, actually this result looks like it has similar event rates, at least in the control group, in all of these other sub cohorts that are typically not part of these trials, including this trial, but yet are very important parts of our society. Do you feel like there's a role there for that? And do you think that at a regulatory level, there's hope that that could be used?
Now, that's a tough question. I think that with real world evidence, I think it matters because you can actually see the data and so forth. My concern with that, though, is that also very biased and also looking at a certain populations that are getting healthcare versus those that are not. And are we still missing people that need to be, you know, observed in this kind of environment is what would concern me. I'm not quite sure. I can't speak for the regulatory bodies, but I'm not quite sure they're fully ready for real world evidence. But I think that that is the direction we should go and at least look at and look at patterns that may help us to further figure out how to move forward with those types of populations or data sets that we're going to be looking at.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, not to give up on getting diverse cohorts, I think every effort is going to be needed to bring more balance to the body of evidence that we generate.
Absolutely.
One of the things that I'm really passionate about is sort of looking at the electronic health records and being able to much more accurately identify who's eligible for trials across the entire health system, not just a first come, first serve kind of approach. I think the first come, first serve approach is not going to allow us to change the narrative, right?
Right.
But if you can see everybody, then you could oversample and say, I'm going to really reach out to more women, to more elderly patients, to more, you know, Black and Hispanic patients, to make sure that they are seen, they are evaluated in a very proactive way to participate in these studies, because otherwise we won't be able to get them in, right? That's the kind of thing. Do you agree? Like, is that something we should be doing?
I fully agree. I mean, if you look at the electron, if we look at it in totality, I think that definitely is the way to go.
What do you think is the biggest risk to innovation in drug development right now? Because, you know, there's a lot of pressures, right? It takes about $2 billion to bring a drug to market, maybe a little more than that now. And it's patent lives are shrinking because of the Inflation Reduction Act. Drugs aren't getting adopted in the market once they hit the market. You know, it takes 17 years to get a guideline recommended drug adopted. These are kind of crazy numbers to think about. The incentive for big pharma, at least, to support fundamental discovery, fundamental sort of drug development, and all of the challenges that are in their way, you know, how do you think about still preserving the value of the randomized clinical trial and making it maybe, or reshaping it? Do you think it needs to be reshaped for the next era of drug development?
I think it'll always remain, randomized control studies will always remain the gold standard. However, I think it's really important to be open-minded, to be able to introduce other ways of collecting the data, looking at the data without, you know, compromising the potential outcome. I think we have to be innovative. We have to be able to not expect something to be 10 years down the line, but maybe shorter in order to be able to get an answer.
I mean, with the trials, it strikes me that the biggest impact that you can have is rapid recruitment. It's certainly one thing, and you know, not taking a year, but taking 6 months. That would be amazing, right? Because that would then allow a drug to be cheaper to develop and get to market faster, and obviously if it worked.
Right.
What about, I mean, the other thing that I think about is choosing the right patients to do the study in, right? And are those maybe the highest risk patients, right? Which we often do that, right? You think about the TAVR population, the first trials, the Everest trials, they were like in the sickest patients, right? 90 years old plus, had no surgical options. And so we started there, right? And that was successful. And then we broadened. I don't know that we do that as much though in pharmaceutical trials, right? Where sometimes it feels like we're going after massive markets in terms of populations, but that makes it harder to show a difference. And I think, you know, it'd be interesting to see that cohort optimization piece of like getting the highest risk, highest event rate populations to be found in the population, recruited and tested. Maybe you don't need 5 years to see the difference. Maybe you only need two.
I think you bring up another interesting point, a very good point. I think our population in cardiovascular medicine has changed. And this goes back to the beginning of our conversation, is how well people are being treated with cardiovascular disease. And so a lot of times, even discovering a new therapeutic or a new product, medication, is challenging because we give them medications that do actually change their risk. So I may bring in a very high-risk patient, so I think they are high-risk, but you're treating them for high blood pressure. You're controlling their glucose. You're controlling, you know, all, you're modifying their risk. And so it's, they're not really at high risk. They, through time, they become a lower risk population. And so I think you're going to need more numbers and you're going to need a longer study in order to be able to see a difference based on that change alone. And I'm just talking about cardiovascular studies. I'm not, you know, necessarily talking about other types of disease states, but at least I could speak for cardiovascular disease. It depends on the treatment, but I really believe that we are treating our cardiovascular patients better. And it is much more challenging to find those types of patients that you need in clinical trials. And thus, you know, these trials are taking longer in order for us to see the event rate or to be able to see a difference.
Yeah. I mean, that really gets back to almost bringing together the, certainly the, you know, the clinical development teams that are sort of helping to plan the trials at the very beginning of designing the cohorts you want. But at the end of the day, that trial will have efficacy demonstrated in a narrower cohort of patients. So you also probably need to engage the implementation side and the commercial side of the organization to say, you know, our projected sales of this compound are going to be different because maybe smaller population to address, but that's still a high risk population. Maybe the cost of that population to the whole system is much higher per patient, you know? So these are things that are fascinating to study, and bringing it all together is difficult, I would imagine, but
it
sounds like that's kind of where things kind of need to move. Otherwise there's going to be a stunting of the growth or the innovation, really, because it's not going to, people are going to look at it and say, well, is it worth it still to invest in this area of research, right? So I think that's my worry, at least.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I agree 100%.
What are the things you're most excited about in terms of work you're doing already at Bayer, but also just generally for women's health over the next decade? I think that, you know, there have been some advances, certainly to even the playing field, so to speak, but still major disparities. But are there specific things that you are doing with the community or within your company that you're excited about and wanted to share?
Well, within Bayer, we always, you know, we partner with the American Heart Association, and we also partner with Women Heart, and we try to collaborate with them and really more from the educational side. We try to educate the patients to understand cardiovascular disease, understand their risks. It's more so that we're able to, it's not just about the product. It's more about getting the message out there about their health, the patient's health, and making them understand the disease and what's, you know, best for them. I think what's really important, or what we're really focusing on now at Bayer, is really that that focus on the patient. It always has been, but it's much more focused now on the patient, and really impressing upon the fact that a lot of times it's not just about what the patient was or doesn't want, or what the doctor wants. It's much more of the patient-doctor relationship that we also want to stress, that the decision, their medications, their treatments, their path to within the healthcare system is really sort of a collaborative process and no longer just a one-sided type of treatment or a decision when it comes to their treatment. So I think that's where we're heading also from the Bayer perspective.
as a clinician, I would say the best way to motivate to make a management change or to think about a diagnosis or think about the risk differently for a patient is if something is telling me that as I'm seeing the patient, or even between when I'm seeing patients, like offline, just to get guidance to my clinical team, to me, that there's something that needs to be done. And one of the things I wonder is sort of helpful to that, moving the needle on disparities is to bring up the disparity at the moment that decisions are being made for these patients, right? Like, maybe it's a trial that they're eligible for that you aren't considering enough for these patients, or maybe it's a treatment or a diagnosis that you just haven't officially made in the chart yet. But, you know, we talk about clinical decision support, and I think that that has a bad rap, largely because the way they tried to go after it, which was very sort of ice pick view of this one very discrete decision that was ignoring all the other aspects of the patient care that might be relevant to that decision. You need something more holistic to do that properly. But with that kind of guidance in that moment to say that, you know, historically, women have been underrepresented in this trial, and this trial is active, this patient is eligible for this trial, you should talk to this patient about whether they're interested in this trial, you know, or, you know, historically, you know, women are less likely to be treated for their hyperlipidemia than men for the following reasons, or did you know, and you should have this conversation with your patient about their eligibility, clearly, for a statin. And so these are things that I think are not done. We get into these patterns, and I think that there's an opportunity to automate some of this in our systems so that we stop, you know, forgetting.
Find that it's challenging to be in a practice where you're given a certain amount of time and there's so much going on with one person that you can't even tackle everything that's going on in the time frame that you have. And it's not, you're not able to do it justice to be able to actually talk about prevention, which we know really is kind of not always on the table, which helps them further down the line, but also in treating the multiple comorbidities, right? Or multiple issues that they have, that it's just difficult to get in that 15 minutes. You know, they come in with one problem, but then, you know, that's not the only thing they really have going on, you know, at a certain age or at a certain point in life. And I think that also is a big challenge in our healthcare system that is, unfortunately, the way it is right now.
Yeah. I mean, I think most conditions do coexist with 2, 3, 4 other comorbidities that also need attention, their diabetes, their hypertension, their dyslipidemia, in addition to their ACIB or whatever primary issue they're seeing you for that day. And I think for me, my survival is contingent upon my nurse, who is an angel, who helps kind of make sure that I don't miss the big stuff. But even she would struggle with all the small stuff on her own. But if we gave some capability to see at least a checklist of the things that should be done for patients, even offline, maybe that would help not allow for holes to sort of persist in their care, right? So I think that's kind of the a vision that I've been very passionate about. It seems like the disparities that you focus on, maybe there's an opportunity there to talk about, you know, interventions that would at least not depend upon the precious minutes in the room with a patient, but could potentially at least be shared as a checklist for the care team and for the patient. You know, why not, right? This is all evidence-based stuff. It's just, you know, we can show it to a patient, we can show it to ourselves and our clinicians, and so why not, you know, make it a shared process, which is what everyone talks about, right? The shared decision-making for patients.
Shared decision-making, which is what's so important now. And, but, you know, I think it is a challenge now to practice, only because it's, I also feel sometimes the patient can't always take away the message we want for them, because you have such a short time with them. You know, they get so overwhelmed coming in with the one issue and having the other multiple issues that unfortunately cannot always be addressed. But, you know, hopefully things will improve and you know, we can continue to help the patients the way we want and should.
And we're kind of coming near the end of our time on the podcast. So I wanted to give you a chance to voice any sort of new projects that you're focused on or new sort of goals that you have within your organization or in your health disparity work that you wanted to kind of make sure we talked about today.
Well, I was recently asked to join the New York chapter of the American Heart Association to work with young women and STEM. That's a passion of mine because I think it's so important to be able to let young women know of all races, of all socioeconomic backgrounds, the ability of what math and science, engineering, et cetera, can do in order to help them in their careers in the future and get them excited about science and get them excited about math and show them what, you know, their future potential can be. And so I'm really excited that I was just recently invited to do this. And I don't have any details yet, but, you know, it's sometime in the near future that we'll be having an event. And I'm just really excited that I can do that for the younger and newer generation. And
that's amazing. Congratulations. That sounds like an amazing program. I know the AHA does tremendous work in with the community, really engaging the community with role models, of which you would be a wonderful one for those young aspiring physicians from all walks, not just young women, but all of them. But like, I think that the opportunities that are, you know, available with the right help, with the right guidance, is really tremendous. And I'm glad that you're involving yourself with that important work.
I think it's important to be a mentor and to be able to give the younger generation those opportunities, right? They may not know that they exist. So just being there for somebody or just opening that one door for them is just, I think, something that we should be able to give back and be able to do. And that's, so I'm really pleased to be able to contribute in any way that I can, big or small.
Well, please keep us posted on the details as they become available. We'd be happy to promote that through our networks as well at Clint and my own at Stanford. So I think we'd love to know. And, you know, my colleague here at Stanford is Joe Wu, who's the president of the AHA. And he would love to hear about it, I'm sure, the good work that, you know, they're doing all the way down at the grassroots level, which is always, you know, impressive to me, but I'll definitely want to relay that back to him. So, but yeah, it's, no, it was wonderful to spend this time with you, Rosa. I look forward to seeing you soon at some of the conferences coming up, and, really appreciate your insights and comments today. And you know, to our listeners and you can find this podcast at the Beyond the Charts, through the LinkedIn page as well as our website. Wanted to thank all of the team members at Clint and for helping us produce this today. Stay tuned for future episodes and take care. Thanks, Rosa.
Thank you.